are ready, I'll have the clerk call the case.
The court will now call Robert Ernie Wilson versus the State of Texas, the man in the court, and the Ottaway to Auditorium of Appellant, Mr. Willem Vanderbilt to Auditorium of
My name is Andrew Ottaway. May it please the court, counsel. This case comes from Hood County, and the question, the only possible question is, can the Court of Appeals extend the religious exemption to religious preference for one one kind of practice? Now, in Hood County, the practice is somebody else does the appeal. Whoever does the trial work, whether they're retained or appointed, somebody else does the appeal. So you get appointed on the appeal, and you go to the first three available sources of information. You go to the client, you go to trial counsel, and you go to the family. And when those things happen, you have to manage everybody's expectations. Now, clients have certain expectations on appeal. They generally think it's a do-over. You get to start again, and you get to add new things in the Court of Appeals. So the first thing appellate counsel has to do is explain to the client and to the family and sometimes to the trial attorney that you don't get to start new things in the Court of Appeals. You have to look at what error was preserved. And so in most cases, you say, the trial court erred by. Well, we don't have that in this case because the things that are important to the client are not preserved. For instance, there's a great deal of time devoted to the motion to suppress. Well, a policeman going down the street sees smoke coming out of a house. That pretty much answers the motion to suppress. The trial court heard the motion to suppress and denied it. It was submitted to the jury. Did the policeman have probable cause to go in a house with the front door open and smoke coming out? Of course. So the jury found that adversely to the client's expectation. But most of this case, or a great deal of this case, was taken up with this religious preference expectation. Nowadays, it seems like, you know, I've been doing this a long time, and for 30 years ago, you had facts and law, and that decided an appeal. But now you have facts and law and preferences. I mean, it used to be things were decided on the record. Was there an objection? When you write a brief, you read for objections. If there's no objection, you write an Anders brief. But people don't like Anders briefs, and they don't understand them. And the client gets it, and they say, well, you know, what kind of a 49% lawyer did I get on appeal? So the option is you raise every possible ground rather than have to write an Anders brief, because nobody likes Anders briefs. And if you, in this case, if you write an Anders brief, you get the client raising that issue themselves. Well, in this case, in the clerk's record, there's a 100-page motion to dismiss, 2 pages of motion to dismiss, and 98 pages of stuff that was never presented to the trial court. There was never a ruling on this issue. So the question is, can a court of appeals go into the pleadings and into the, really, the cross-examination of witnesses and find this extension of a religious preference to this substance? Now, the legislature hasn't. The question is, can the court of appeals? Now,
don't we have... We've got this interaction between Smith, Scalia's Smith opinion in the Peyote case, where basically it was perceived to have reduced, shall we say, religious freedom, if you will. The specific response from Congress was RFRA, and then in the Bernie Church case, that the Supreme Court kind of gutted it a little bit, but still, and Texas has a Texas RFRA, but it may have, may or not, may not have been asserted in the motion to dismiss, but it was never heard.
It has to be presented, and you have to have a ruling, and the legislature didn't grant. I mean, they granted, they talked about peyote, but they didn't talk about mushrooms, so.
Is the peyote exception actually in the Texas RFRA?
Well.
Or is it on?
I don't know.
Or is it in something else in terms of controlled substances?
I think it's in the health and safety definitions of.
Okay.
So.
Didn't remember.
But you have to.
But there's little doubt that if it is in the health and safety code, the reason there's an exemption there is specific to religious practice.
Right.
Okay.
And so to preserve this.
But there wasn't a generalized, you can take anything, you know, any crime with regard to a particular type of drug or intoxicating, whatever, there's not a generalized, it's very specific to peyote only, correct?
Right. And the problem is, well, you know, it's mushrooms, it's natural. How can you control something that's natural? Well, so are opium poppies. They're natural, you know, and so I understand what we're up against in asking the court to extend this. But I want to preserve the client's expectations for the next level, and you can only do what your client asks you to do if there's any possible way. And so there is a possible way for somebody somewhere to say this should be an expansion of the religious practice.
Let's just assume for purposes of argument that in fact the trial court had heard the motion to dismiss and denied it. Okay. On what basis would we be finding that denial was an inappropriate denial of religious freedom?
It would depend on the testimony. I mean, who testified in support of the motion? What evidence is there in support of the motion?
Well, let me give you an example. One of the reasons why I think Scalia was in, you know, was dealing with the neutral application was, particularly when you're dealing with conscious altering type of substances, is that there's a public health aspect to it. And what prompted the officer here to begin with is he ran across someone not your client who was under the influence, and under the influence apparently in proximity to the place that had the open door with the smoke coming out of it, and ended up getting in a scuffle with this individual, and therefore there's some evidence in the record, would you not agree, that the religious practice that apparently was ongoing in this home, there's some evidence that it was a threat to public safety, would it not have been?
And that's why it's hard for the Court of Appeals to do anything when there's been no testimony that I've belonged to this church for a long time and we were halfway through the procedure or we were halfway through the ceremony, and that's the kind of things that you would balance.
Was there anything in the record that indicate the individual who was originally arrested had in fact come from the home, or had the reason that they were, that individual was acting in an intoxicated or a influenced manner was because they had participated in some type of religious practice in that home?
I don't remember that being in there. What I remember about that person is they took him to the hospital and discharged him shortly after. So, and he didn't come to the trial and never was heard of again. So,
well, what standard will we apply to determine whether or not this was a legitimate exercise of a religious right? I mean, anybody can say that.
Right. I mean, that's why you have a hearing on pretrial motions, and somebody determines whether there's. But it's just this, just the mere filing of it and of the motion and raising it in cross-examination of, for instance, the defendant's dad and the police officer, did that raise a possibility?
Well, there is some testimony from the witnesses that, in fact, the use of these mushrooms was made a part of, or at least they were aware that your client claimed that the use of these mushrooms was part of a religious practice, sincere religious practice?
Yes.
Okay.
And beneficial to health. I mean, there's some testimony about that. So,
how are we to judge the sincerity of a religious practice?
It's hard from this record
to do that.
Yes.
How would we ordinarily do it?
Well, usually the person gets on the stand and say, I've belonged to this church from the last 6 years, and my wife's a member of the church, and we go, and this is the ceremony, and this is the order of service.
To show that it is, in fact, a practice.
And sincere.
Sincere. Is there any case law out there where somebody can just simply show a membership card and that would be sufficient to do it?
I believe there is not. I have access to quite a few things, and I looked.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Ottaway, I think I've heard what you've said. I think I've understood what you've said, and I want to tell you I appreciate your candor with the court.
Well,
agreed.
These days, the clients have different expectations. I've been doing this 40 years. An old man from Comanche took me in the back room and he said, Andrew, here's how you talk to the family. And the family made the decision not to pursue the appeal. They'd rather send $20 a month to put on his books in the commissary, because as if the trial lawyer, the appellate lawyer, and the family decided that an appeal would probably not work out. Nowadays, you just exhale the word appeal and you've got this process triggered. So it's a different way.
Thank you so much.
Madam Chief Justice, Mr. Justices, Mr. Ottaway, and may it please the court. I'm an assistant district attorney in Hood County. I've had that job just a little while now. I, in fact, was just sworn in as a lawyer yesterday, as an attorney, so I appreciate the opportunity to come up and address the court on this issue. So in 1940, in Cantwell versus Connecticut, the United States Supreme Court explained that the free exercise of religion encompasses two concepts. First is the right to believe, which is absolute, and the second, which is the right to act, which in the nature of things cannot be. And I think, Mr. Justice Birdwell, you made a really good point about why the right to act cannot be absolute. In this case, there was that individual wandering around the neighborhood outside of Granbury, Texas, who was clearly intoxicated, being belligerent, at one point attempted to resist arrest from the officer who came upon him. And that sort of conduct, that sort of intoxicated conduct in public, is the sort of thing that the state's police power exists to circumscribe, to make sure that public health, safety, and morals, which have all been recognized as legitimate uses of the police power, can be protected, which is why the state has the authority to circumvent certain conduct, even if a person's sincere religious beliefs indicate that they don't wish those regulations to apply to them. They nevertheless do. And Mr. Justice Birdwell, you really ran down the Employment Division versus Smith and City of Bernie cases as well as I could, so I'm not going to waste any of this court's time with explaining what the situation is in terms of religious liberty in Texas. Suffice it to say that a neutral law of general applicability is enforceable in the state of Texas, even if it incidentally burdens the religious practices of an individual, which means that in order to prevail on appeal, the appellant would have to ground his claim for relief either in general constitutional principles or in the Texas RFRA. And I'd like to address the Texas RFRA initially. It's in the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code, and it has never been held to apply to a drug case. There have been numerous challenges. The first one, immediately after Texas passed its RFRA, was in Burton versus State out of the 14th Court of Appeals in Houston, where somebody who was a practitioner of Rastafarianism asserted their right to smoke marijuana as a religious sacrament, as part of their practice. The court absolutely rejected that claim and reiterated that because of Employment Division versus Smith and Ramos versus State, which was the Court of Criminal Appeals cases that held Employment Division versus Smith to hold true in Texas, those sorts of drug regulations are not the sort of thing that you can raise a legitimate constitutional challenge to. Now, the primary case relied on by the appellant in his brief is the case of Utah versus Mooney, which is inapplicable for three reasons. The first one is that Utah's not Texas, and they were dealing with a different set of laws that don't necessarily apply in this case. Specifically, in terms of the second reason, the Utah Controlled Substances Act wholly incorporated federal exemptions and federal definitions of controlled substance in their definition section. They said anything that is included as a controlled substance under the Federal Controlled Substances Act was a controlled substance in the state of Utah. Anything that was accepted from the Utah Controlled Substances Act. And that's how they used the Indian land use laws and a couple of other peyote exemptions to say that peyote would be legal in Utah. Texas has no need to do that because under 281.111, I believe, of the Health and Safety Code, there is a peyote exemption. The use of peyote for bona fide religious ceremonies in the state of Texas is constitutionally protected so long as you comply with DPS requirements of registration and growing and things like that, which the Moonies in Utah did. They bought their peyote from Texas because that's the only place that it can be grown. They complied with all of those regulations. That's not the case here because as this case turns on, the fundamental issue of fact is that psilocin and psilocybin mushrooms are not peyote. There is no exemption for psilocin and psilocybin mushrooms in the state of Texas. And if there was to be an exemption, then it should come around the same way the exception to peyote did. It's a legislative issue. If people think that for religious purposes psilocin and psilocybin should be allowed, then they are free to petition the legislature. They're free to go ask and try to make the same exemptions. And as the legislature showed just this last session, they aren't shy about changing drug laws in Texas. So there is a mechanism by which these drug laws can change, and then this isn't it. And with that, if there are no questions from this panel, I believe that the law in this is fairly well settled.
The only point on appeal today is whether or not the case should have been dismissed.
Yes, ma'am.
And in the state's brief, you point out that, although I recognize you probably didn't write it, but you point out that Wilkerson did not request a hearing on his motion to dismiss, and the court did not hold one. And I'm curious as to why you haven't briefed or argued that appellant's point has been forfeited and waived.
I did write it, Madam Chief Justice.
Okay. I mean, it's an interesting issue about the religious freedom and the use of mushrooms and peyote and everything.
It is.
Part of the matter is that motion to dismiss that they're complaining about, the complaint that it should have been dismissed was never presented to the court and was never ruled on by the court.
Yes,
it seems to me a clear case of just waiver.
Yes, Madam Chief Justice, that could have been addressed on appeal.
I'm just curious, there wasn't a reason, you just missed it.
Yes, Madam Chief Justice.
Okay. Any other questions?
Just out of curiosity. Apparently there's an exorcism of some type going on.
Yes.
When the officer comes into this room.
Yes.
Is there anything in the record to indicate that the treatment, the restraint of the individual or the assault of the individual had been made the subject of any type of criminal activity, criminal prosecution? And if not, would that not be some evidence that the state considered what was ongoing in that room, which might include the mushrooms, to be a sincere religious practice?
The state does not contest that the Wilkersons genuinely believed what they were doing was a religious practice. They were straightforward, and part of the trick here is there were two cases. There was Mr. Wilkerson and his wife. She's not on appeal today, so I'm trying to restrict myself solely to his appeal. So I'm trying not to get crossed over with what facts came from which trial. But it does appear that the Wilkersons were sincere in their belief that this exorcism was a part of their religious practice, and there's no indication that the individual who was being exorcised at that house was anything other than a completely willing participant who wanted to be there, who wanted to be doing that. So, no, Mr. Justice.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you have a rebuttal?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, we appreciate your argument here today. Your case has been submitted, and you are now free to leave and go about your business, or you may stay and listen to our 11 o'clock hearing if you wish. Thank you.